The saxophonist and composer Branford Marsalis grew up immersed in music in Louisiana. Along with his brother Winton, Branford has played a large role in shaping the style and sound of contemporary jazz music. Branford Marsalis has achieved a level of public notoriety that is rare for jazz musicians. From 1992 to 1995, he worked as bandleader for Jay Leno's Tonight Show. And throughout the 1980s and 90s, Branford participated in high-profile collaborations with rock and rap musicians, including Sting, The Grateful Dead, and Public Enemy. Branford has also worked extensively as a composer, scoring over a dozen films and television programs. Branford Marsalis will make two appearances in Indiana this month, including a January 25th performance in Bloomington and a January 26th date at the Palladium in Carmel. I recently spoke with Branford Marsalis via Zoom. Branford, thank you so much for joining us today. It's an honor to feature you on the program.
It's a pleasure, Kyle.
Yeah, your last couple releases have been soundtrack albums. I wanted to ask you about that. You've released scores for the films Rustin and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I understand you've also recently composed a symphony, which is scheduled to be performed this March by the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra. Tell us a bit about your work as a composer, and is composition occupying a larger part of your life these days?
I don't fancy myself as a composer. When you listen to the like, great composers, it's clear that they did that. They didn't do TV shows. They didn't play with, you know, popular music. They didn't play jazz. They composed. And I really confidently believe that had I started composing at the age of 20, now at the age of 63, I'd be writing some really good stuff. Not to say that this stuff is bad, but, you know, what I write is melodic, and I try to write as honestly as possible, so I don't go to the harmony book to discover complicated music techniques and throw them in because it would seem to me inauthentic. That kind of complexity, I think, is developed over a period of time. I don't think it's something you can acquire in school for a couple of years. And when you do it that way, it tends to sound that way. So I'm a musician, a player at heart, and I love playing. And I also love composing, but I love it so much that I differentiate between what I do and what they do.
So you're not retiring from performance anytime soon?
Every time I've had an opportunity to walk away from it, I've gone back to it. So I had to accept the fact that I'm a player.
Branford, I want to ask about one of your early experiences as a professional musician. I think you were a teenager when you joined Art Blakey's legendary group, the Jazz Messengers. This band shaped the career of many young musicians. They've been called Blakey's School of Music and the Hard Bop Academy. What was that experience like for you joining this iconic jazz band as a teenager?
You're almost there. I was 20. So, yeah, I was emotionally very much a teenager, but Blakey was not really fond of me, which was fine with me, because as long as he was willing to dispense the knowledge to me, I'm a lot like my dad that way. I didn't need to be liked by him. So he was invaluable to me as a developing musician, because his lifestyle was a bit wild for my tastes. But his knowledge of music, I've met few people who knew as much about jazz as he did. And the nuts and bolts of how to have a band, how to develop a bottom-to-top understanding of jazz and the function of each musician in the group, he was absolutely brilliant for me. And when he didn't have answers, he directed me to musicians who he knew would have the answers. So it was an invaluable part of my musical development. We'll be right back.
I want to ask about one of the records you recorded with Art Blakey. A lot of my work revolves around the music history of Indianapolis. We have a great jazz legacy here. You were featured on an album titled Killer Joe, which also included the Indianapolis trombonist and arranger Slide Hampton, who was part of the legendary Hampton family of musicians. Do you have any memories of working with Slide on that record? Were you touring with him at all at that time?
Was that the record with Joe Kawaguchi?
Yeah, it came out in Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. That record was a blur for me because it was Joe's record, and Joe was a good friend of Art, and it was just like a Joe Kawaguchi Art Blakey love fest. Huh. Slide lived four blocks from me, so I saw Slide a lot, but it was more social than musical. He was a wonderful man. I mean, he was really nice. He was nice all the time. He never seemed to be in a bad mood when I saw him. I'm sure he was in his life, but when I saw him, he was always in a good mood, and he wasn't very judgmental or righteous in those ways. A lot of the older guys really resented us showing up and made their displeasure known. But Slide was always great. Slide was great.
Branford, you've performed and recorded with many jazz icons, including Sonny Rollins, Dizzy Gillespie, Horace Silver, and Miles Davis. In 1984, you were featured on the Miles album Decoy. To me, recording with Miles Davis seems like the ultimate credit you could attain as a musician. Was it that way for you? What did it mean to record with Miles Davis for you?
I learned a lot. You know, it wasn't like we were... You know, it wasn't like I was taking Wayne Shorter's place in the Great Quintet, you know. But that band, like John Scofield was killing. He was great. The whole band was great. But I learned a lot about how to play from that session. He wrote down some changes and said, play these. And I started to play them. It took me a while to figure them out. And then he says, okay, now don't play. And when I was feeling insecure, which was all the time in that session, I started looking at the sheet. So he made that loud whistle that he makes when he wants everything to stop. And then he took the paper and crumpled it up and threw it on the floor and said, now play. And I started playing, and I knew hints of it, but I was forced to react to what the band was doing. It was really a good lesson for me about, I mean, when you talk to some of the older guys, post Charlie Parker, and even during Charlie Parker's time, they were around then, they always talk about playing the changes. And I think what made Miles different was that he wanted you to learn the changes but play the sound. So once you get the structure of the song, then trust your instincts and just play. And I've used that as a model since 1980.
I grew up during the hip-hop era, listening to the music of artists like A Tribe Called Quest and the Diggable Planets, groups that prominently featured jazz samples in their music. Listening to that music deepened my appreciation for jazz. You embraced hip-hop in your music. You recorded with Public Enemy and Guru. Your group Buckshot LaFunk featured the legendary hip-hop producer DJ Premier, among other rappers and DJs. What did hip-hop mean to you at that time? And tell me about your embrace of this music and culture at a time when a lot of people were trying to distance themselves from it and put it down.
Well, I grew up playing pop music. I didn't grow up playing jazz. I mean, a lot of people would put it down because they saw it as a threat, which makes sense if you think about it in a certain context. If you have been good at a thing, and all of a sudden there's some new people showing up doing another version of that thing, and you can't do that thing, then you feel that it is in your best interest in terms of surviving to diminish the importance of that thing to prop up the thing that you do. And there was a lot of that going on. It was strategic dislike. But I was a kid, and I was always open to everything, and I wanted to understand what they were doing and learn what made it unique and what made it great. And it wasn't just that they used jazz samples, it's how they used the samples. Premier was brilliant at that. He would listen to jazz records and he would hear things in places, and I was like, man, wouldn't he'd take something and he'd take eighth note, like he took this one eighth note phrase and somehow in his hearing he turned it into triplets and then played it on a slow groove and it had these triplet sounds. I was stunned by how good his ears are and how great his instincts are. So, we were all young. We were all young, and I never grew up believing that everybody was supposed to be a jazz. So I wasn't intimidated by that music at all. It was a great time.
And you have two upcoming performances in Indiana. One is here in central Indiana at the Palladium. The other is at the IU Auditorium in Bloomington. And this is a somewhat significant venue for you. Your 1991 performance at the IU Auditorium was released as a live album in 1993 under the title Bloomington. Does Bloomington, right, Indiana hold any significance for you?
I mean, I love Bloomington. I love the music program. Mm-hmm. It's a serious music school. I mean, even now, I really have a lot of respect for the program. The reason we called the record Bloomington was there was a debate amongst us, me and my brother Delphio. I thought that the performance was incredible, but it had such a, like I was talking about with composition, it had such an advanced tilt to it that Delph said, I don't know, man, I don't think it was that good. So Delphio gave the tape to my then 16-year-old brother, Jason, who was quite brilliant. And he fell in love with it immediately. And he called me. I was listening to Bloomington, the way you guys do this, that, and the other, because he has that genius brain. So when we finally agreed we would release it, and I said, what are you going to call it? It's that the sound of Jason at 16 constantly calling it Bloomington. I'm like, okay, it's Bloomington.
Did you ever connect with David Baker, who started the jazz program at Indiana University?
Well, yeah, we had a connection. So, I mean, when we played, we did a master class at the school that day. And Bob Hurst, our bassist at the time, went to IU and studied with David Baker. I've met David at various points, but I didn't study with him the way Bob did. Bob studied with him for 4 years and loved him immensely.
Anything you want to share about these upcoming performances in Indiana?
I wish they were in June and not in January. Other than that, no, we look forward to playing for the people. We love playing for people, and we love playing with each other. So it's for a lot of people that come to concerts, they come to see it more than they come to hear it. which is why in our country, the operative verb for concert going is see, not hear. Everybody's going to see a concert. And what I learned was that at some point you have to take people at their word instead of saying, like we try to make this equivalency thing. Oh, well, they meant hearing. No, they meant see. That's why they said see. So we try to give folks something to see as well as something to hear, you know? And if they see us enjoying ourselves, I think they tend to enjoy that, you know, as opposed to standing up there very demurely with a scowl on your face and disengaging from the band when your solo is finished. I think they enjoy that a lot less. So our shows are really interactive, and we love to play, and we love playing for people.
Yeah, it is going to be cold while you're here, so yeah, be prepared.
Bruh, you think I don't know that?
Man, thank you so much for taking time to do this today, Branford. I'm a huge fan of your playing, and again, it was an honor to feature you on the program. I appreciate it.
Pleasure's mine, Kyle. Take care of yourself.
You can catch Branford Marsalis performing live in Indiana on January 25th at the IU Auditorium in Bloomington and January 26th at the Palladium in Carmel. Listen, download, and subscribe to the Cultural Manifesto podcast at wfyi.org or wherever you get your podcasts.